Some companies have this policy, some companies don't, but it's the results only work environment, or ROW, if you're using the acronym, which basically says, I don't care how many hours you work, providing that you hit those KPIs and you produce the results that you've been brought on to produce. Do you care whether your team are using AI or not if it is producing the results that you want? Do you care that somebody is a heavy user of AI if that is a part of what you need? You know, do you need somebody who you don't care whether they're authentic or not, providing that they can use the AI to achieve the results that you want? Hello and welcome to Tech for Finance, where we help finance professionals leverage technology to level up their lives. I'm your host, Adam Shilton, and my co-host today is Daniel Lawrence at Bots for That. Now, this is the second in our This Week in Tech series. It was a couple of weeks ago that we did the last one, wasn't it, Dan?
It was, already.
So Dan has his own podcast as well, Beanies in a Pod, so make sure to subscribe to that. And make sure you also subscribe to Tech for Finance on your favourite platform and on YouTube. But we're going to kick off today with some of the stuff that's been kicking off over the last couple of weeks. So the biggest topic, I guess, is Microsoft Copilot. So I guess to demystify it a little bit for people that maybe haven't used it or still don't understand the Microsoft terminology, because I still don't quite understand the terminology myself. But Microsoft built OpenAI into Bing quite a while ago. So the first iteration of Copilot, in inverted commas, was Bing Chat. And everybody shouted about it because it was a free way to essentially use the same language model as ChatGPT in the background, right? But it had some limitations, especially compared to the pro version of ChatGPT. No plugins, no advanced data analysis. So it was basically predominantly a chat interface. But you had the advantage of it being connected to the web. So that's why some people used it over ChatGPT, because at the time, that web search wasn't available to everyone. Since then, Microsoft rebranded it to Copilot. So it went from Bing Chat to Copilot. Then they allowed you to use GPT-4, which is the more intelligent model in it, for free. And now you can switch to turn on the GPT-4.5 Turbo. And again, all you need is a Microsoft account to get started, I think. But the biggest shift...
And money.
And money, yeah.
It's not free.
No, that bit's free. The next bit is the paid for bit. So what they've done now is they've built Copilot into Office. So previously it was just a standalone that you could use on the web or in a similar way to what you'd use ChatGPT, but now they've built Copilot into Microsoft Word, Microsoft PowerPoint, Microsoft Excel, OneNote, and Teams if you're using the business edition. So there's two flavors, just to make things easy to understand. There's Copilot Pro, which you can use in personal and family plans. It's the one that I've got access to at the moment. And then you've got Copilot for Business, which works alongside Microsoft Office Standard, Business Standard and Business Premium. And I believe if they've not done so already, they're also making it available to the E3 and E5 plans as well. But the reason that this is such a big thing is because it's allegedly going to allow us to augment our work that we do as part of our day-to-day office jobs. You will literally have a Copilot, almost like a virtual assistant, living within your office applications. So I've had a bit of a play. I'm not going to speak too much. I want to get Dan's perspective first. But Dan, have you kept up to date with this? Have you used Copilot? What are your initial impressions?
Does this all seem vaguely familiar to anyone, I wonder? Does anyone remember Clippy?
I remember Clippy.
Let's call this Clappy. it's basically Clippy on steroids, isn't it, really? I mean, ultimately, it's a chatbot. What more is there to say? I mean, really, that is the nuts and bolts of it. It's a chatbot. There's millions of them out there. We've used it. We've played around with it. We've used quite a lot of conversational AI chatbots. There's a lot of much better ones. I'm sure Microsoft will get better in time, because that's what they do. They buy something else and then improve it and make it better. I asked the team. So I said, you know, check out Copilot, see what you think, report back. It was the funniest thing. One of the guys on my team came back and said, well, I'm sure my dad would be impressed with it. Enough said. I mean, you know, it is what it is. It's a chatbot. It's going to be like all the others. I think it's not for me. It's never so much about the tool itself. It all comes back to having a need. What are you going to do with it? Why do you need it? Why do you want to use it? And it's the same with any tech. It's almost like, I know we'll go over this same ground, but it's always start with the basics of what need do you have? What's your purpose? Then pick the tool that's going to give you the best result for the best return, that sort of thing. So it's, for me, that still all applies. I'm still not convinced that, I guess Microsoft users in general, but desktop users are still, I'm still sort of, the jury's out for me still on democratization. I know everything's trying to push it that way. But you know, we want everything to be served to us, generally speaking. So for people who are inclined, and I'm sure it'll be a great tool, I'm sure people will get some use out of it at the desktop level, I don't think it's going to really take off at the business level so much. I think there's so much competition in this space, and I think paying more for it is not necessarily required, to be honest with you, from what you can get out there. So have you tried it yourself?
Yes, I am. So, I do like it. I think it's still a bit buggy at the moment. It's not as groundbreaking as I thought it would be, but that's not to say that it's not still pretty cool. So, I guess, if we look at the different applications in isolation, there's different use cases, right? There's an argument to say that the best Copilot is going to be in Word, because you are using a language model, which is technically better with words than numbers, even though I know that they're getting better all the time, which is good. So you can have the AI provide guidance, you know, restructure this paragraph, you know, how can I word this better, give me some ideas for this, which is great. But I found that there is still a big variance in the sort of output that you're likely to get using similar prompts. So, for example, I used the example of creating a board pack. So, you know, I'm a CFO and I want to create a board pack for this month's board meeting. You know, give me the outline structure, yeah, essentially. And the first time it did it, I was really impressed with the results, because it didn't just produce blanket text. It segmented the headers, you know, so title, subheading, paragraph. But then what it also did is it included tables. Yeah, so heading, paragraph, bullet points, tables, and it came across as really well structured, and a really good starting point. But then, because I was recording, obviously, because I try and publish as much as I can, I wasn't recording the good response, because that was my first sort of test and play with it. So I thought, oh, this is really good. I need to record this, and I need to make sure that people are seeing this. Second time I did it, it still had the headings and the structure, but it literally just gave me bullet points. Yeah, so there was no combination of paragraphs, bullet points, tables, that sort of stuff. And I don't want to see that initial good result and then think about, right, well, how do I engineer the prompt to get that good result that I saw the first time? So I think, obviously, that's coming from somebody who's written thousands of prompts and, you know, has seen all of these different various outputs. But I think it's just worth bearing in mind is, you know, inspiration, structure is great, you know, but don't try and save your prompts and think that you're going to get the same output every time, right? In Excel, again, really good. It speeds up the whole visualization piece. You know, so have a look at the table, give me some ideas for visualizations, you know, and it will try and surface information that you might not have thought of before. And the closest that I've seen to this previously is, and I'm sure you've seen it in Power BI, when you could click the little light bulb and it would come up with suggestions. Yeah, so these are insights that you might not realize. But the difficulty is, it will produce a scatter plot, a graph, or whatever based on the data, but there isn't really a logic behind why that is useful. So you could quickly just end up producing a load of visualizations that don't really mean much. You know, so that's my initial observation. What I was quite impressed with, though, is not from a visualization perspective, but from a creating a calculated column. So it gave a suggestion, so I wasn't even thinking about it, but it said, oh, do you want to add this formula to be able to compare X and Y? And I thought that was really good because I wouldn't have thought of that by myself. And then on the PowerPoint, and again, I think this is where most of the ground needs to be made up, because you can ask within PowerPoint for it to create a presentation outline for you, but it looks like a school project because it's going to put in images based on the stock image library or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
So if you're wanting to create a presentation on brand, it's not going to do that. Mm. So just a word of caution that if you are getting it to structure your presentation, that you might be switching out quite a lot of images. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I did quite like is for a fully formed presentation, you can click a button that says organize presentation. And it'll add in sort of like subsection slides for you. So it will group your slides so that, you know, it comes across in a more logical format. So I quite liked that. Mm. I've not tried it in OneNote yet. I've done the Outlook email summary, which is okay. What I quite liked in Outlook is it's got an email coach, you know, so tone, sentiment, that sort of stuff. Similar to Grammarly, if you've ever used Grammarly in emails and that sort of stuff. But it was quite funny because I did actually use it to generate an email. And then I used the coach to analyze the email that it generated itself, and it just pulled it apart. It was like, this is rubbish. And I was like, well, you produced it, but there we go. So, sorry, I'm talking too much. But there are some cool use cases. But
I think the best way to think about using this technology is initially for inspiration. So you might already have formats and templates for board decks and presentations and stuff. It's worth doing a little exploration. So write your prompt to say exactly what you need and give me, you know, a presentation or a slide deck that does this, just to see if anything new comes out, something like you said you hadn't thought about. But ultimately, if you're in a business, you're a CFO, you're a finance, you already know what you want to put in that. You already know what investors and shareholders want. You already know what the board wants to see, or whoever your audience is. You already know what they want to see because you're running a business and you've already got metrics and patterns. So use it to produce those, to get the data, to grab it, to do it in the format that you want it. So just eliminate the production work. You've already got a lot of stuff. Use it for inspiration, definitely use it for the production, and then use it to identify patterns. One thing that the AI and the tech that we're talking about is very good at is patterns, and they'll detect patterns that we don't. So use it for the things it's really good at. You know, analyze this over the last 5 years or the last 10 years, compare this with this other set, you know, use it to try and find patterns and eke out things that you haven't spotted. And sometimes it might reveal a gem, sometimes it might reveal nothing whatsoever, but it's no harm in using it because it doesn't cost any time. And that's the way I would actually start using this, because I think that's where the adoption will get much better, because I think people will see more value from that.
I think the coaching piece is an interesting topic. But obviously we need to be careful that we don't get into bias and just becoming robots ourselves by just being, you know, blindly led by the AI. But I like using it as a sounding board for a different perspective on how I can get better. Because everybody grows up, you know, it could be argued a subjective circumstance, and you carry out a number of activities on a regular basis. So a lot of your behavior is ingrained. And you don't always think in terms of other perspectives, especially if you work in a job where you don't meet a load of people, you know, or, you know, you don't run a podcast and have conversations with loads of really interesting people. So having that AI to say, look at this, how can I make this better? You know, is there any way that you might do this differently? You know, so I think from a continuous improvement perspective, it could be quite good. But I've been thinking about this quite a lot recently in terms of...
Not too much, I hope.
No.
I know you.
But,
no.
but in terms of what are the ways that we can use AI thinking in the long term, i.e., you know, not just the quick wins of, you know, do this for me, but in terms of how can this make me a better human? Mm-hmm. And the way that I'm thinking about it is like a learn, assist, and do model. So for me, I'm quite keen to use AI for that learning piece as much as possible. So if it is generating code or it is helping me out with a formula that I can ask it, right, well, walk me through this. You know, I'm keen to learn the structure behind this. You know, why have you produced this? Talk me through how you've done it because I want to learn, right? Mm. The second piece on the assist side of things is what we're talking about with the likes of Copilot, right? You know, so I think I'm there. You know, I just need a little bit more help. You know, so I need that template so I can then take over from there, or I need to compare this data, but then I will surface the insights or communicate the story. I think that top do category, where people are trying to get AI to do everything, I think we need to just tread really carefully.
Yeah.
So if you were to look at it in terms of a pyramid, the biggest element would be that learn. The second biggest element would be the assist. And then the smallest part would be the do, where, you know, you might be in a scrape, you know, and you quickly need to generate something. But as I say, I'd avoid trying to get AI to do stuff. I think we need to be in that learn and assist territory.
Yeah, I would almost treat this... imagine you're trying to teach a new person a job or a task. Treat it in the same way, so that you do, they watch, then you go through the next phase of they do, you watch, and then ultimately they'll be performing stuff for you. But don't think it's going to be an overnight, you know, process, because it takes time. And ultimately, the thing with AI, you don't want it to have a generic output that sort of loses your voice and your personality and what you're doing. So, yeah, you're right. You need to be careful. You need to be selective. But start with things that are productive. Start with the doing things, the production of things. Get inspiration, and use it as you said, as a coach. Yeah. But it's experimentation. I think the most important thing is forewarned is forearmed. So. Learn how these things work, because if you learn it in this way, you're learning how it works generally across in other factors as well.
I think coming back to Copilot, and if I were to give a bit of advice to kind of summarize things, if you've got experience, you know, either basic, intermediate, or advanced experience using the likes of ChatGPT and other large language models, so you've done prompting, you've experimented, you know, you've improved your results. I think moving over to Copilot and trying to talk to Copilot in office in the same way as you would a large language model direct, I think is going to lead to disappointment. Mm-hmm. If you're using the standalone Copilot, great, because it works in exactly the same way. But within Office, we've got to bear in mind that the Copilots are specific to a spreadsheet or specific to Word. So they are trained to provide guidance alongside those mediums.
Yeah.
So my recommendation is there are pre-canned prompts that are suggested within Copilot. So I'd start there, because there is reason why they are making those suggestions. Yeah, so start with the suggestions. Don't try and reinvent the wheel and go from there. What's also quite interesting about Copilot, and I don't know how far this is going to get, because technically it could be another store or marketplace, is there is a prompt library. I can't remember the term for it, but you can go into the Copilot, you can expand the menu and click on the, I can't remember the name of the term, but it'll open a new tab, and you can see like all these different prompt templates that you can use. So I'd have a go there. Start using those suggested prompts to really learn about the use cases within Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and so on, and then start increasing the complexity. But as I say, Copilot's still in its infancy. You might find when you increase the complexity, you get worse results than using the suggested prompts. So don't invest too much time. Don't think it's going to solve all of your problems.
No.
Baby steps, I guess, is the...
Yeah. I think when these things all start working together in unison, yeah, that'll hopefully should be improved a lot more for us all.
Yeah, and just on that point, and when I originally saw the Copilot demos, and I've spoken about this online, is one of the best use cases I saw was repurposing. So take that board pack that might be a Word document, you know, might be you know, two or three pages, difficult to present a Word document. So being able to say, create a presentation from this board pack Word document is a really good use case. Unfortunately for me, because I'm using the Pro Edition in a personal edition of Office, I'm struggling. It can't find the files. So I try and say, create from this file, and it can't find it. So I don't know whether it's because it needs Fabric, or it can't recognize my OneDrive, or I need to give authentication. but I think there's better use cases with the likes of Business Premium, Business Standard, E3 and E5, because you've got that SharePoint fabric layer whereby you can connect the different documents together. So that's a really interesting use case that I'm hoping people use more of. I've just struggled a little bit, as I say, I think it's one of the limitations of me using the Pro versus the Business Edition.
Yeah. And I think one of the that's probably one of the things to try and avoid is a platform specific tech. Because ultimately you don't ever just work on one thing, and you don't ever want to get tied to one thing. You know, your clients or other people in the business departments might use different technologies and different, you know, they may use Google Docs in one area and Microsoft in another, and you want to just sort of work seamlessly across in the same way that we would. You don't want one that suddenly steps out the side of the realms of Microsoft Word and or Microsoft and stack, and it suddenly can't do anything. That's what you want to really want to avoid. I think the one thing you want to do is something that's almost agnostic. Really, that would be when it starts to work for us.
It's an interesting point, because I think Dante Healy, had him on the podcast. We've been on each other's podcast. I think he commented on my Copilot post when I did the initial walkthrough. And I think I just ended the comment thread by saying something like, just confirms my suspicions that Microsoft are going to rule the world. And I'd be interested to get your take on this. And I don't know whether you've ever watched the TV series Mr. Robot with Rami Malek.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch that?
I did.
So for people who maybe aren't familiar, is Mr. Robot is kind of one of those sort of psychological dramas, I guess. So Rami Malek, who's the star in it, he's a hacker, you know, and he is trying to bring down, I think, is it called Big Corp or something like that?
That's right.
So basically they live in this future where the entire world is run by Big Corp. So there are no other businesses, you know, similar to Wall-E, you know, the film with the little robot. That's the same principle. There is one company that basically provides all services in the world. Are we getting to the point where one company could have so much power within the tech stack? You know, when we look at Microsoft, it's not just Copilot, obviously, it's Power Platform, it's, you know, all of that sort of stuff, which, you know, is really valuable to a lot of organizations. Are they just going to end up dominating to the point where other companies can't compete, or do you think there'll always be other use cases and niche use cases for different companies?
Well, we're probably at the point where we've probably got 5 or 6 companies that run the world anyway.
Yeah, okay.
We're already there, really. I just don't think it's going to be as sensationalised as we see in the films and the series, like Mr. Robot, because we're already there, really, aren't we? Let's face it. You know, there's five, six companies, if you take it from food to fuel to tech, all the way through. There's 6 people that run the world. It's not governments. It's not us. It's already happened. It's been there for about the last 15 years, 20 years, to be honest with you. But no, I don't think it'll be as sensational as that. But yeah, it's nice to put it in those terms, because it makes it a bit sexy, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully, we'll put it this way then. Hopefully we will still be able to maintain freedom of choice over the application.
Well, I don't know about that. You think freedom of choice? We think we have that now? Really?
I don't think I've got the brain power this morning to go down that rabbit hole.
You need
down.
A couple more coffees. But mind you, that's only really the Western world. There's a whole chunks of the world that Microsoft do not have that level of dominance. So we're a long way off of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I mean, maybe I'll hook you up with Sasha at some point. So Sasha Orloff, I had him on the podcast. He's the founder of a company called Puzzle.io. And they're building an accounting platform mainly for founders that's just got generative AI at its core, you know, so that, you know, if you don't have a finance team, it's a lot easier for you to, you know, understand your numbers, and obviously AI forms that assistant, right? But he said in passing on the podcast, I'm inclined to believe that we live in a simulation anyway. So we're not,
the Matrix.
Yeah, we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But yeah, if you do want one of those mind-bending conversations, I'll introduce you to Sasha and you guys can fill your boots. Very good. So the next on the conversation topics, and I know you're into this sort of stuff, Dan, because you like your sort of AI ethics.
I do.
So I saw a recent article, and the headline was EU AI Act Draft Leaked. And you'll probably be able to set more context for this. But the way I understand it is the EU are now trying to add some governance behind the way that AI is used. And I think the whole headline revolved around the fact that probably people got hands on, you know, a draft of that act before it was ready to be released to the world. So I don't know whether you've seen it, whether you've got anything to add.
I didn't see the leak thing, but it didn't really surprise me. I've been following the EU one and there's a US one as well, the Bill of Rights, for same thing to make sure that, was it automated systems work for the benefit of American people? I think it's called something like that. Not for the world, just for American people. So they're all basically fundamentally flawed, aren't they? And let's face it, the fact is that we're approaching this from a country or any other perspective, it is already a failure, because it means we're missing the point, really, of what AI is, which is really fundamentally the problem with ethics with AI. I won't go into detail, but ultimately their ethics are based on ours. So they're fundamentally flawed. So, but no, I didn't see the leak, but I didn't think it was sort of a leak, really, because I think they've been inviting a lot of people. They've been sharing a lot about it anyway for the last couple of years. They've been inviting lots of, you know, comments and commentary on it. But it didn't really raise an eyebrow for me, to be honest with you. I was more surprised that we, 2 years on, and we still haven't actually seen something. Was that sort of the purpose of someone leaking it, to try and force it along? You know?
Well, that was my first thought, was why does it matter that it was leaked? Mm. Because at least, you know, we're seeing some sort of progress. You know, obviously the naysayers will you know, pull it apart and have something to say, I'm sure. But I have to admit that I've been a bit in the dark behind all of this policy. So I mean, I've spoken quite frequently about the way that people need to understand ethical and correct use of AI as opposed to just blindly following it, as we mentioned previously. But the governance piece, you know, I think you and I have spoken about it before. Yeah, it's great having an act and a policy, but how many people are actually going to listen to it and follow it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've got two problems, I guess, with AI in misuse of it. Companies using it to exploit and take advantage of people. Through media and other things, and we see fake news and all over the place, and ultimately people just believe what they read. So that's one danger. The other one is people maliciously, intently using it. You know, the other thing I saw recently was there was an article on quantum computing and AI, and it talked about, you know, it's only a question of time now. It's probably going to happen sooner rather than later, where the quantum breakthrough happens and no system is unhackable. Whether it's military, commercial, banking, finance, whatever it is, they'll all be hackable within, you know, split seconds. And there was a few questions posed. One was, does that effectively render AI completely useless at that point? Because all bets are off the table at that stage when that happens. And there's no AI that's going to counteract or save that. Or can it be used for a power of good? And what, you know, where does it go from there? So there seems to be at the moment, like I say, with that leaked one and a couple of the other articles I've seen, and another one in the context of crypto as well, there seems to be a few sort of new issues surfacing all around the same time, the topic, and it's hard to know what to believe, isn't it, because I don't even know if AI wrote half of those stories.
And we could go down a rabbit hole here, but
I've tried not to.
that's fine. But I was a little bit scared when I first started seeing the fakes, the deep fakes, because that immediately raised the question, right? Well, what is real? Mm-hmm. What is not real? So, I guess moving beyond an AI act, you know, in terms of what it can and can't be used for, and all of that policy. Mm. I think there needs to be some narrative around that, and it's difficult to put into words, that authenticity. Do you know what I mean? And maybe let's bring this back into a finance context, so we're not getting too out there for our listeners, right? But if I'm, you know, senior finance and I'm leading a team, right? I will bring on people with select skill sets. You know, based on a combination of hard and soft skills, based on, you know, how well I think they're going to slot into the team, right? And I had Craig at Arctic Shores, VP of Finance at Arctic Shores, and they actually do an algorithmic approach to hiring, which, you know, goes beyond the CV, and it's I guess it uses AI and a framework to determine beyond a CV the aptitude of a candidate. And he's and the company have been publishing quite vocally about how candidates are using AI to fake their way into to landing a job.
Yeah, right? It's inevitable.
Yeah. So forgetting about the deep fakes, is the solution here that we need to be moving more towards human to human interaction, so that we're not as reliant, but we're not as vulnerable to employees hiding behind a screen, hiding behind a wall of text. What are some actionable steps that somebody can put in place to ensure that they're limiting that risk of having the wall pulled over their eyes? We might not have an answer, but you hear what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. I'm going to repeat myself, but it if you're a CFO of an organization, it all comes back to your why. You know, you know you've got a business strategy you're following. You know that you want to achieve certain things. You know, you go through an assessment of, that's what we've got to deliver. Can we do this alone? No. So who are we going to bring in? Now, do we bring in new people? Do we bring in technology? Do we utilize the likes of AI, automation, and other tech stacks that are our advantage? And what does those things cost? So I think you've still got to go through that same determination. You've still got to have a purpose. You've still got to have a need. And then you assess what you're going to use it for. And if you think, well, we've got a massive hiring campaign going up, well, there are companies that can cut through the stuff for us and do it probably a better job than we do to deliver us A players to select from. If you wanted to really use AI, I think you know you're getting into grounds of, unless you've got experience of it, you're probably just going to get lost and probably make bad decisions. So I think there's tried and trusted ways of doing things, and I think we don't need to get blindsided, I suppose, by the hype of what might be possible, and lose sight of what we're really good at. And I think that's the thing with finance folks: there's things that we're really good at, there's things that we're not, and we've got to not stay in our lane, right? But we can use technology to where it makes sense, and that comes back to the why. So it makes sense to use tech to do things that will speed us up, save us time, save us money, deliver a quicker, better, faster result for less time, you know. But other than that, I don't think we need to get too blindsided by all of the things that are going on. And you know, I think we'll just lose time. I know you've found this personally, right? You can find yourself on a track and you suddenly realise 2 months later you haven't made the progress that you wanted to, but you sort of got lost and you've followed lots of different roads, but you haven't actually got an outcome from it. And there just isn't time, really, I think, most cases.
So, solving for the wrong problem. And again, the marketing doesn't help, you know, bombarded every day by, oh, you know, this new cool AI tool. And we mentioned previously, you know, the whole sort of turbo, you know, software, turbo edition, AI edition, you know, you need to get this, otherwise you're falling behind, all that sort of stuff. It's easy to get roped into that narrative. But coming back to what you've said there about the foundation is where you want to get to. And it reminds me of, and I guess it was a bit of a movement. Some companies have this policy, some companies don't, but it's the results only work environment, or ROW, if you're using the acronym, which basically says, I don't care how many hours you work, you know, I don't care when you work, providing that you hit those KPIs and you produce the results that you've been bought on to produce. So I guess it depends on your mindset leading a team. Do you care whether your team are using AI or not if it is producing the results that you want? Yeah. Do you care that somebody is a heavy user of AI if that is a part of what you need? You know, do you need somebody who you don't care whether they're authentic or not, providing that they can use the AI to achieve the results that you want? You know, so yeah, maybe we're getting a bit.
No, I think it's valid. I've got different opinions on that, I'll be honest with you. I think once you're doing that, you're no longer really a social organisation, are you? And at that point, if you can get to the point where your employer doesn't care whether it's you or your tools doing the work, you're instantly replaceable. Because if the tools do it, why the hell would they be paying you a salary on top of paying for the tools? And also, you know, a company doesn't run that way. You know, it runs on people. The tech's an enabler, but the tech will never run the business for you. The business is a collection of people. Ultimately, those people form a culture which represent what your business stands for. And those core values are what suppliers and other customers associate with, and if they align, they'll do business with you. Not because you've got an entire workforce that works in every single location in the corner of the globe using tools and tech, and you never see one another and never speak to one another. That's not an organization. That's just a service, you know, which anyone could do. So if we get to that point, then why would they even bother having you as a customer?
So, yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, I take your point there. Mm. You know, and again, maybe the question there is, what type of business are you trying to build? You know, and taking technology out of the equation, you know, I've worked for companies in the past that haven't had an employee culture first type makeup. It's just been a, we need to hit this revenue target so that we can sell the company. So I guess it depends on your ambitions there. Obviously, there's going to be more longevity in a company that does revolve around culture, you know, and having that shared vision of the difference that you want to make in the world. But I guess that's by the by. But I guess if I were to play devil's advocate a little bit there, so let's say that I'm running a finance team. I have a setup at the moment which could be, you know, accounting system, you know, I could be using other tools for HR, CRM and all of that sort of stuff. And of course we know that there's platforms that can join up that data and allow us to surface insight, right? But let's say in a larger organization where the finance team is bigger and there's a lot more moving parts, you know, and your processes can't be covered by, you know, all of the tools that you use because you've got that level of complexity. Now, I know you do work in this because, of course, you're a robotic process automation specialist, right? But coming back to finding somebody who can just do the doing irrespective of whether they form part of the culture or not, let's say that somebody knows how to use AI to write Python code or VBA code or whatever, and they're able to come in and they're able to join the dots, you know, they're able to speed things up, you know, and add that seamlessness to the workflow. Do you care whether you see them or not if they're enabling you to get to the next stage of your growth?
Personally, yes, I do. Yeah. And ultimately, if I'm the CFO or the CFO organization, the buck stops somewhere. And if you don't know that person, what else they do while they're working, what's happening to your data on that screen in your organization, if you don't know all those things and you don't know what's going on, you're going to get caught out at some point, I believe. You know, some, for me personally, yes, it does matter. Everyone in our company has to be known. So we're not going down that. We might be a technology company selling technology solutions, but we're still a people company, and that's what we march on, really. So yeah, for me it does matter.
I'm not recommending people do that, by the way. I'm just trying to...
Yeah, for me it does, and I think it always will.
Yeah. So staying along that chain of thought then, so I did a post last week on Python specifically. It was just a bit of a, you know, use case. These are the libraries that you can use to achieve these ends, right? And I get a lot of finance pros that are asking for Python training courses and all of this sort of stuff. Is that a long-term skill set, do you think? Do you think in finance that once the base processes are automated, because of course tech is getting better and better, that we do need to be upskilling in, you know, automating with code or getting into that data science territory? Or do we think that if people invest time in building that skill within 2 years, it's going to be redundant?
Well, I'm certainly not against it. It's funny because I had a similar conversation about 30-something years ago when we were asked in one of the companies I worked in, would it be a good idea if the rest of the business learnt how accounting worked and finance worked, because it might make our jobs easier. So it's quite a nice flip. A couple of decades later, we're having the same conversation in reverse about the tech world understanding, or the finance world understanding tech. I'm not against it, but I'm not convinced. I think... yeah, there's an element of redundancy to it, but there's one thing learning a skill. So let's flip it around, right? So if I understand, if I'm a tech person and I understand, okay, I know I've someone teaches me how debits and credits work. Okay, I know I get that. That doesn't mean you can go off and produce a full set of accounts tomorrow, or should be trusted with the financial operations of a business just because you've learned what double entry means and how it works. And it's the same thing with coding. Just because you understand how some coding works, there's a lot more to actually building a robust, scalable, maintainable solution than learning how to put in a piece of code. That's actually where mistakes and big things can go wrong, because people are dangerous enough to know one thing but not the context of what they're doing within the business. And I think this is probably a big challenge of democratization as well, is people can make very quick, very big mistakes that can cost the company, you know, huge amounts. I've lost time, lost data, lost money. And so I'm not against people understanding more about what the coding does, how it works, why it works, why it does, so that they can get use out of the tools around them. But I think just learning how to code or how to build a piece of code for no real benefit, I don't really see the value in that.
So let me apply a bit more context then. And again, you're the master of all of this automation stuff, so you tell me, right? So I'll use a personal instance first, and then maybe we can think about a finance use case. So I've got two personal instances of where I've used AI to write code to produce an output. So one I've mentioned previously is with the podcast, yeah, because I had feedback that long form was a bit of a struggle with people. You know, so they'd struggle to sit through an hour and 15 in one go.
Yeah.
So they would prefer, you know, the 25 to 45 minute type, you know, shorter chunks. But the problem with that is, you know, I've got to import the full podcast into a production platform. I've then got to render two lots of video and then re-import them back in. So I'm creating not just double the amount of work, but considerably more than double the amount of work in just splitting a podcast in half, right? So I asked ChatGPT, is there a way that I can split the video without having to do any sort of import, export or whatever? And it came back and said you can use FFmpeg or whatever it was. And it helped me write a bit of code where I could select the file. It would split it in half based on the timestamp that I gave. And then I've got two files instead of one without having to do that import, export routine. So that has sped up things exponentially for me in, you know, a 5 minute conversation with AI to produce that Python code. Now, of course, I needed that pre-existing knowledge of Visual Studio Code, you know, how to think in terms of building the app, you know, how to think in terms of using the command prompt in the background once the code had been triggered and that sort of stuff. So I do have a bit of grounding there, but no reason why you couldn't learn that in 5 minutes using AI as a coach. The second instance was more of a work scenario whereby we had to give data in a specific format to a supplier. But we didn't want to give all of the data from our systems to the supplier because it's sensitive information. So within our business systems, we've got, you know, a data table that's got 20 odd rows, including who's communicated with a customer, you know, last contact date, you know, all of that sort of stuff. The supplier only needs to know the name of the company and where it came from. Yeah. Now, historically, we'd have to download the data file into Excel. We'd have to look at the mappings to determine how each of those customers was categorized, and then we'd have to reformat that into the table that was permissible by the supplier. Yeah, and it could take hours. So wrote some Python code. It looks at the four downloads from the raw data. It looks at the columns to determine a row of this type will mean this category in the new spreadsheet to be submitted to the supplier. And then it drops out a very simple two column customer date type of customer category, whatever it happens to be. So that saved 3 hours, and I built it into an app so that people don't even have to have Python on their PC, right? They literally just click the app, select the folder, and it does the rest of the work. Okay. A finance example, you know, I often hear about, you know, we struggle with consolidations, or every time we want to do cost center analysis, we've got to post to multiple GL accounts, you know, and we don't always know what cost centers we want to allocate to that transaction at the point of entry. We want to be able to do it as part of our month end process, right? So I know some tools will do that, yeah, but you've got to pay a premium. So long way of asking, in the same way that we do a back of the fag packet, you know, Excel model or calculation or whatever, do we think that we could get to that territory where you've got a bit of back of the fact packet codes that you can use for little niche use cases that might not break your organization because it's pretty low risk, but you've still saved hours that could be repurposed into more value added work, right?
Mm. Yeah, and in fairness, there's probably tools out there that you don't need to even go and find out what Python code is, even if you're inclined. There's tools that are drag and drop that you can do exactly the same sort of thing with the same outcome without having to even think about that. Because ultimately, if you want to democratize it, you've got to make it accessible for as many people as possible. And a lot of people are not going to want to go into coding and even get, like, they don't have your level of base knowledge to start with. So there's some really good, I guess, you know, desktop, drag and drop, low code, no code solutions that you could do the same sort of thing with. I think within any organization, you know, the IT group generally wants to make sure that the stuff you're using is safe. There's, you know, you've got connections to the, you know, certain data needs to be, again, we're almost back to the AI policies and stuff like that. But, you know, what are you using? What are you connecting it to? All that, as long as all that's in place, I think everyone will find what works best for them. There'll be people out there who will love to do exactly what you've done. There are others who will just want it served to them. I think having choice is brilliant. You know, I think that's the most important thing. All we're talking about is the choices that are now and the options that we've got are opening up more than we've ever had before. Whereas before it was just you either had to try and grind it out, or maybe you do a web search to try and find some insights and, you know, build a template and do something. So the options we've got, the speed that we can get now is more than we've ever had. But I think there's always, as we know, a word of caution with all of these things.
I totally agree that a low-code, off-the-shelf tool could be the path of least resistance.
Hmm.
But what I found, and sometimes I struggle with the low-code tools because, again, you need foundational knowledge of the different elements that make up that low-code tool, and you need at least some understanding of, you know, the steps, the different types of element, you know, the drag and drop. It's exactly the same, you know, if you're sending a marketing email, you know, you need to know what the block is to drag into the email newsletter, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. My experience, and maybe it's just because I spent time doing it, is I sometimes find that I'm fighting against low-code tools because I know the output that I want, but I can't find the preceding steps, which is why I found AI useful, because you can build that into a conversation. You know, so this is the output that I want to achieve. You know, take me through how I can achieve that step by step. So that's probably just personal preference, right? But I guess it all stems, and tell me if I'm boring you at any point, Dan, from actually a real life nightmare scenario that I had in a previous life. So I was working in the Dynamics space, and we were on the bleeding edge. You know, it was around the time that Microsoft decided to take Nav at the time, which was on-premise ERP system, and put it in the cloud under Business Central, which now still exists, right? It's a cloud ERP platform. Obviously, it sits within the Microsoft suite. It's pretty cool. And now Business Central has a co-pilot. Surprise, surprise. But either way, when that first went into the cloud, they changed the coding language. Yeah, so you couldn't use the development environment that you would previously. You had to use Visual Studio Code. You had to download the Microsoft AL language to configure and change the system. So instead of having a consultant, you'd need a developer to make changes to the system.
Yeah.
So I sold all of this, you know, newfangled Business Central stuff on the bleeding edge, and then people came back and said it was working, but now it's updated and something's broken.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what had happened is, for whatever reason, a bug in the system had hidden half the fields in the order entry screens that were fundamental to transacting.
Yeah.
So I had customers come into me saying, it's broken, we can't use it, what do we do?
Yeah.
Support weren't trained at the time.
Yeah.
The developers were still getting up to speed with the AL language, so I pulled an all-nighter, because I had no option, otherwise I'd lose customers, right? So I went through the Microsoft tutorials on how to use the AL language and the code to build those fields back in. Now, I'm not suggesting anybody do this because it was massive risk, right? Because I was then going to customers and installing packages without a developer background. So I'm not saying that's the right thing to do, but in that process, I got immersed in code. And I saw the real life use cases of actually being able to help from having that foundational knowledge. So maybe it's just that's something that I haven't been able to move away from. Maybe it's just because I like the coding piece, yep, that I like, yep, the Python, but not everybody works like that, right?
No. And in fairness, this is something we've seen 40 odd years ago, when someone got hold of Microsoft and built macros. And 20 years, 30 years later, you go into an organization and they say, oh yeah, we're using this thing that Jeff built 27 years ago, and no one knows how it works, and it's broken. And that is always a risk with these types of things. And that's why I think, having it's great that people can build things, but I think organizations very quickly become dependent. They just take them for granted. That's the thing, that's the solution, that's always going to run. And it's not always the case, because the systems they work on change. We see all the time that companies change their software platform. Some of the changes that they put don't even appear on the release notes. There's 50 odd changes, and none of them even mentioned on the release notes of what's been changed. But fundamentally, now the thing that you built suddenly falls over and doesn't work. So not only are you losing the time that you've gained from that normally running, you've now got to go off and solve it. Generally speaking, you probably won't get the support of an IT organization behind you, because they'll say, well, we didn't build it. It's not our problem. It's your problem, right? So there's goods and bad. There's pros and cons with all these sorts of things. I think you've just got to take a common sense approach to it. And ultimately, you've got to come back to, the finance organization are brilliant at certain things, and other things you can outsource, and you can, refer to other folks to do things for you. And I think there's things to explore, but you just got to take it with a pinch of salt and just be very cautious, because you can make, dependencies, and you can create a lot of big mistakes. And I think exploring it, learning it, is definitely the positive side of it.
So if you've got that itch to scratch, learn a bit of code, but don't profess to be a developer when you're not.
We've seen it even in our world. Some of our guys have occasionally, regex is another really great example. And it's a minefield. I want something very specific. Go on ChatGPT. I want regex for this. Brilliant. But you've already got a solution designed from top to bottom, left to right. You know exactly what you're doing. There's context around it. The outcomes are clearly understood. You're working for users with their defined requirements. That's brilliant. If you've got something that's concise and unique, and you can get that, and you're testing it within the broader context of an overall solution, and that you can throw anticipated failure test cases at it, as well as success ones, and you can really make sure that, yes, that's going to be stable, it's going to be robust, it's going to be scalable, it's going to be maintainable, it's going to be easy for someone else to understand. If you can do all that, then it works. But we've seen equally examples where people have just said, well, write me something that does all of this, and then it's a pile of dog mess, to be honest with you. And we've seen AI try to write stuff on its own, and it's a mess. You look at it and think, well, why the heck would you design it that way? It doesn't make any sense.
It's not just understanding of the code, it's the understanding of the context and the limitations. So as you said, maybe it's a case of learning enough to be dangerous so that you can think in those terms, but not to the point where you're trying to develop like massive amount of code to build applications and do all of that sort of stuff. That's where you need more practice hands.
But these quick fixes become quick wins, and suddenly your dependencies are there that people aren't aware. I think if you're going to do things, people in the organization need to be aware of what you're doing. So, I've built this unique thing, solution. It does this. This is how it works. If I'm ever run over by a bus, you know where it is. That sort of thing. That's where your AI policies come into play, your AI governance framework. Who can do what, when, why, how, and what's the framework for getting those listed in a library? People understand where they are, how to get access them. If you disappear, there's continuity.
No, all valid stuff. Now, I've talked a lot, Dan, and I appreciate we're probably coming up to time, because it's almost an hour. Is there anything that you wanted to bring up? Anything from our last conversation you want to touch on again, or are you happy to leave it there?
No, I'm good. I think the thing I see still coming up is cost, actually, interestingly, being finance department. I think the business case for it and the ROI, in a lot of cases, it still isn't working out. I think it's obviously there's big adoption, but I don't think it's mass adoption enough that the cost of AI is coming down sufficiently to be available and useful to everybody. So I think that's still a factor, and maybe we could put that on a list for the next one. is maybe let's dig into the costs of AI in a bit more. Let's maybe do a little bit of a case around it. Let's put a business case around one and work through a few examples.
And do you mean cost in terms of, say, Copilot monetary, it's going to be, you know, $30 a month or that sort of thing?
I think, yeah, we could take it down to individual use cases. And I think, you know, we've seen with Microsoft there, they've invested billions into this. And I don't even know when they're going to break even on this stuff. Because that was just to get it up and running. But to actually make it like version 2, generation, second generation, third generation, where it's actually going to become more useful every day, to that extent where you don't have to try and understand coding and all that kind of stuff. Be interesting to see what, because I'm not sure what's been invested in total, what still needs to be invested to get it to that point. But without mass adoption and subscriptions being paid by everybody, they're nowhere near breaking even on these investments. So how do we, is it actually worth bringing AI in? Because there's lots of cases to look at, but you know, you can just use what's out there, but then you know your data is going to places where you probably as an organization don't want it to. So if you build your own models, for example, what would that look like? What sort of costs would that involve? You know, building a team of specialists and expertise around that, and you know what that would cost. So it's something we haven't really talked about. It's something we looked at in any detail yet.
We can definitely have a look at that. Yeah, but I echo your point, right? Because everybody is pushing Copilot, forgetting about having it in office as a free alternative to, you know, the paid version of ChatGPT, right? You know, and that is a tremendous amount of compute power for everybody that's using Copilot. I think it's just copilot.microsoft.com. Go there now. How is that being covered? So yeah, no, it's an interesting thought experience. Yeah. So we can revisit that next time. Let's have a look and delve into some use cases. Yeah.
I think it'll be free forever. I mean, OpenAI was free for starters, right?
Well, hence the name.
Now look at it. A free democratized open system suddenly now subscriptions. So. It's a bit like drug dealing, isn't it? You give some stuff away, you get people dependent, and then you start hitting them with the big fees.
Exactly. Oh no! I need it! Don't take it away from me!
Exactly.
Alright, Dan, well, we'll leave it there, but pleasure as always. As I say, don't forget to subscribe to Bean News in a Pod. Subscribe to Tech Finance, but give us feedback. Had some good feedback from the last session. People liked you returning, Dan.
Oh.
They like you.
Oh, Christ.
There we go. You know, No, we'll keep on going until we run out of things to say, I guess.
Or we'll start charging for it.
All right, Dan, we have a good day. Catch up in 2 weeks.
No worries. See ya.
Bye-bye.